On June 5th of 2024, a noticeably pregnant Palestinian woman walked down a street in the Nusayrat refugee camp in the heart of the Gaza Strip. She wore a hijab over her hair and a long black dress over her protruding stomach. And she bought vegetables from local vendors while complaining of the hardships of living in the war-torn strip. But this woman was not actually pregnant, and she was not actually Palestinian. The truth is, she was a soldier with the Israeli Defense Forces, or the IDF. She was fluent in Arabic with a perfect Gazan accent, and she was disguised as a local woman. And what appeared to be grocery shopping on this June day was actually her gathering intelligence for a top-secret mission. The mission was necessary because 242 days earlier, on the now infamous date of October 7th, 2023, thousands of Hamas terrorists and other Palestinians had carried out a highly coordinated attack on Israel. In this satanic attack, the Palestinian terrorists had slaughtered 1,139 men, women, and children, and had kidnapped some 250 others to hold as hostages. Among those hostages were three men, 21-year-old Almog Meir Zeyan, 27-year-old Andrei Kozlov, and 41-year-old Shlomi Ziv. And there was also a 26-year-old woman named Noa Argamani. Noa Argamani became one of the most well-known of the Israeli hostages because Hamas terrorists, back on October 7th, had published a video of her being separated from her boyfriend and taken away on a motorcycle driven by a terrorist. You can hear her screams of despair from this footage playing in the background. And in Noah's face, you see just the deepest and most heartbreaking fear. The footage is just horrifying beyond words to watch, and it made Noa Argamani really the face of the hostages. So on June 5th, as the pregnant-looking woman was secretly gathering intelligence near their makeshift prison cells, Noa and these three male hostages were in their 242nd day of captivity in Gaza. They'd been held for 242 days, being transferred from one place to another, often held in extremely bleak circumstances. They were suffering from malnutrition and muscle atrophy, and they were sometimes beaten and otherwise abused by their Palestinian captors. And on June 5th, they likely thought that there was no end in sight to their captivity. Little did they know that this woman was part of an ingenious and courageous plan, and that events were in motion that would lead to the attempt of one of the most daring, high-risk, complex, and heroic rescue missions in recent military history. Today on The Sun Also Rises on KPCG-FM, we present The Diamonds Are in Our Hands, a story of courage and resolve for the history books. So Noa Argamani and the three men had been in captivity since October 7th, but their whereabouts were unknown to Israeli authorities until May 12th. That's when Israeli intelligence learned that they were being held somewhere in this especially crowded part of the generally very crowded Nusayrat refugee camp. And that's when the idea for this IDF rescue mission was first sparked. From that day on, Israeli intelligence agents were fixated on this part of the Nusayrat camp, watching and listening as best they could, 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. They were trying to figure out exactly which buildings and even exactly which floors and rooms the hostages were being held in. The Israelis were trying to figure out the number of terrorists guarding each hostage and what kind of weaponry these terrorists had and every other scrap of information that they could find out. Only a small group of the highest-ranking officials in Israel's war cabinet and in the IDF and the Shin Bet security service were made aware of the intelligence, and of the rescue plan, just to try to keep it all as confidential as possible. The Israelis used aerial observation, and they tapped into a whole range of technologies, but it still was not enough to zero in on the exact locations or to figure out some of the other specifics that they needed to know. So that's when the decision was made, the incredibly high-risk decision, to get some IDF eyes right at the location undercover. The name of the female IDF soldier who disguised herself as a pregnant Palestinian has not been released, but we know that she was part of a small team of deep cover Mista Arvim troops who were sent to the Nusay Rock camp for this purpose. They had all arrived a couple of days earlier, right at the start of June. And they had arrived in this most crowded part of this very crowded camp in broad daylight in two battered old cars. These cars had mattresses tied to their roofs, and they were full, not just of undercover male and female soldiers, but also of all kinds of household items, the kinds of items that most any displaced Gazan family would have had with them if they were relocating. Pulling into the camp in broad daylight was an extremely tense moment for these Israeli men and women. But they stopped their cars and stepped out. They stepped out unarmed into an extremely hostile region, an area where hundreds of well-armed terrorists from the local Hamas battalion lived. And those terrorists were living among thousands of Palestinian civilians. And this is, of course, a people who overwhelmingly seek to rid the region of the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. So stepping out of their cars in their disguises was terribly nerve-wracking. But these undercover Israelis stayed calm. And when the local Gazans asked what their situation was, they said that they were two Gazan families who had fled Rafah in the south of the Gaza Strip due to deadly shelling from the Israeli army. They said that they were now searching for a large house to live in Nusay Rock. One of them produced a large bag of cash and offered to pay a price well north of the going rental rate if they could be housed right away in this exact area. Well, the story apparently sounded convincing, and the cash was enough to quell any suspicions, so within about 3 hours, the undercovers were living in a house on the same street where Noah Argamani was being held. And this was only about a half a mile from the building where the three men were being held. So this was an optimal location for the Israelis, and they began right away to settle and blend into the area and to accomplish their mission, which was to pinpoint exactly where the hostages were being held and what kind of resistance would have to be overcome to rescue them. They worked in two teams. One was a man and a woman posing as a married Gazan couple. The second team was four female soldiers, including the one who was feigning pregnancy. They would make outings on foot, just walking down the streets, stopping at stalls to browse and sometimes buy what was for sale. And they walked with total confidence, as if they were strolling down Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem. And all the while, they were secretly collecting all the information they could. And within a few days, they were able to zero in on a multi-story building next to the Al-Uda Medical Center as the location where Noah Argamani was being held. And they pinpointed another multi-story residential building on the third floor of which the three men were being held. This was in the home of a Hamas activist and medical doctor named Ahmed Al-Jamal. So the hostages were in these two homes of these Gazan families. These undercover Israelis used secure lines to pass this and other information along to their superiors. And commandos in Israel began rehearsing. Intricately modeling how the rescue would go. There were 28 commandos with the famed Yaman counterterrorism unit who would be mobilized. And they created elaborate models based on all of the details available that the undercover Mista Arvim troops had gathered, and based on other intelligence as well. And they began walking through this mission, practicing it, trying to anticipate everything that could go wrong, and how they would surmount all the resistance without risking the lives of these hostages. They would like to have had more time to rehearse and model the operation more thoroughly, but the authorities knew that the hostages might be transferred at any time. So on June 6th, the chief of staff and the war cabinet and the head of the Shin Bet decided it was time to act. And that evening, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave the final approval. The undercovers were instructed to quietly leave the Nusayrat camp. Their work was done, except for just a couple of them who stayed behind just to make sure that the hostages were not relocated at the last minute. Other Israeli cabinet members and senior commanders were then told about this operation that had been in the works for weeks by that point. And then, with the help of U.S. and British intelligence support, the plan was put into action. First, there was misdirection. This happened with the IDF launching a new operation in eastern Biritch, which is to the east of the Nusayrat refugee camp. And then they also launched another new operation in East Deir el-Bala, which is to the southeast of the camp. These operations were launched around a day before the rescue attempt was to begin, and they were designed just to draw as many Hamas terrorists as possible away from Nusayrat, just in hopes of minimizing how much resistance the IDF would face during the rescue there. And then on Saturday, June 8th, shortly before 11 a.m., the 28 Yaman commandos arrived near the two buildings where the hostages were being held. And they arrived in what appeared to be furniture delivery trucks. And they didn't arouse any suspicion among the locals. And then at exactly 11 a.m., the order was given to go ahead.
At 11 a.m., the two teams on the ground received the order to act, which was personally approved in real time by the head of the Shin Bet and the IDF chief of staff. They attacked the buildings simultaneously and in full coordination at the same second to prevent the terrorists in the second target from discovering this, which would endanger the hostages.
That was Yair Pinto there with the TBN Israel channel. He and his associate Mati Shoshana have been closely following this story since it first broke, and some of the information for this episode comes from their channel. And as he said there, the two teams mobilized simultaneously. And back in Israel, the authorities overseeing the whole thing had a live feed of the two target buildings and the street that separated them transmitted directly into their command posts. The team of commandos assigned to rescue Noah were able to quickly eliminate the terrorists guarding her. And one of them knocked on the door to her room. She spoke about this in an interview with the Israeli News 12, saying, "A soldier opened the door and said, 'Hello, Noah, this is the IDF. I thought he was joking, so I didn't move. Then he told me, "I'm going to pick you up over my shoulder, is that okay?" That's when I realized it was actually happening." By 11:06 a.m., the Yaman commandos had Noah safely out of the apartment, and the Israelis were able to get her to a waiting helicopter that flew her back to Israel. The helicopter crew delivered her to the Sheba Medical Center near Tel Aviv, so she is safe. After 245 days in captivity, Noah Argamani is now home, and she is safe. Just a little side note here. Noah's mother, Leora Argamani, was suffering from brain cancer throughout Noah's captivity. And she had publicly appealed for Noah's release on several occasions because she badly wanted to see her daughter, her only child, before the cancer overcame her. And thanks to this rescue mission by Yaman and the Shin Bet and the IDF, Leora Argamani was able to be reunited with Noah on June 8th, just hours after Noah was freed. and Noah stayed by her mom's side for the next several weeks until her mother did succumb to the cancer on July 2nd. So Noah's rescue back on June 8th went relatively smoothly, but the simultaneous situation with the three male hostages, Almog, Shlomi, and Andre, quickly became very complicated. These three were being held in the home of Ahmed Al-Jamal, a Hamas activist and medical doctor, as I mentioned, and Al-Jamal's son, who is a journalist, sometimes writing for Al Jazeera, was staying in their home at the time too. Well, thanks apparently to the reconnaissance work from the undercover crew, the Yaman commandos knew exactly which room in this multi-story residential building the three hostages were being held in. It was up on the third floor, and the commandos were able to use a ladder to enter directly into that room through the window. At the same time, the larger part of this Yaman crew, led by a 36-year-old commander named Arnon Zamora, went into the building's main entrance on the first floor. They immediately came under heavy fire from far more terrorists than they were expecting to find in this residential building. Around 30 terrorists were inside, armed with machine guns and even grenades. And the Israeli's commander, Arnon Zamora, was wounded very early in this firefight. The Israeli Yaman commandos who had entered the upstairs window heard what was happening down below, and they put the three hostages they were working to free inside of a bathroom. And the commandos guarded them, hoping that the gunfire downstairs would soon subside, so that they could extract the three hostages. At the same time, down on the first floor, Commando Zamora's men divided their attention between administering first aid to him and working to eliminate the terrorists who were unleashing heavy fire on their position. The commandos were winning this extremely fraught battle, eliminating the terrorists one by one. But the trouble was, the sound of all the gunfire was clearly audible to the locals, including to hundreds of other armed terrorists who lived nearby. Many local terrorists had left this area a day or so earlier because of those new IDF operations that had been launched for the express purpose of drawing the terrorists away from this hostage rescue location. But there were still hundreds who remained in the Nusayrat camp. And these remaining terrorists began rushing in from all directions, with some even popping up out of Gaza's infamous tunnel system. And they began closing in on the Israelis. Most of these terrorists were firing small arms, but some had shoulder-fired RPGs. This rapidly growing army of terrorists targeted the Israelis and their vehicles. These terrorists, of course, wanted to prevent the Israelis from completing the rescue at all costs, so they unleashed everything they had on them. But the commandos were able to eventually get the wounded Arnon Zamora up onto a stretcher and out of the building. And at the same time, the other part of their crew was able to get the three hostages outside as well.
At 11:15 a.m., the announcement that everyone was waiting for is reported. The diamonds are in our hands.
The diamonds are in our hands. That meant all four hostages were freed. After 245 days of captivity, these diamonds were in the Israelis' hands. So that was the best imaginable news. But the timeline for the mission had been thrown off by Commander Zamora being wounded and by all the Hamas terrorists joining in the battle. So it meant that the exit route that the Yaman commandos had intended to use was crawling with heavily armed Hamas terrorists who were spraying bullets in all directions. So it required the commandos to improvise and adapt. I'll read this next part of the story from the Jewish Chronicle, an article that was published on June 13th. It says, "The Israelis started making their way out of the building, with several of them carrying Arnon Zamora on a stretcher. They were running through smoke-filled alleys and the nearby market, which was crowded with thousands of Gazans who would not have hesitated to lynch them. The Israeli forces tried, under constant fire, to get to the rescue vehicle that was waiting for them, but it was hit by two RPG missiles. That was a major setback for the Israeli operation. The rescue vehicle was destroyed by two rocket-propelled grenades. Back in Tel Aviv, the authorities overseeing the whole mission realized that they had no choice but to activate Plan B. This meant bringing in the big guns from several military divisions. I'll go back to the Jewish Chronicle for this. With the help of tanks, hundreds of IDF soldiers from the Golani and Givati infantry brigades and paratroopers. These hundreds of soldiers charged on foot into the refugee camp, fighting face-to-face battles with Hamas terrorists, while at the same time Navy ships covered them from the west and Air Force helicopters from the east. So there it is, Plan B very quickly brought in Israeli forces from ground, sea, and air, providing cover for the Yaman commandos from multiple directions. Air Force jets and helicopters, Navy warships in the Mediterranean, and ground troops from the 7th Brigade. This was highly unusual to have all these branches involved in a rescue operation of this kind. But all these reinforcements were enough to isolate the battle scene and open up an escape corridor for the Yaman commandos and the three men that they were extracting from captivity. If that weren't unusual enough, at least two IDF helicopters then landed, even amidst all the RPG fire happening below. These helicopters landed in this viciously hostile territory just for long enough for the Yaman commandos, including the wounded commander and the three hostages, to load onto them. The helicopters took off, heading toward the same hospital, the Sheba Medical Center, that Noah Argamani was heading toward several minutes ahead of them. While they were en route, attempts to revive Chief Inspector Arnon Zamora continued. But when the helicopter landed, this 36-year-old husband and father of two was pronounced dead. And it was shortly after that that the name of this incredible mission was changed. During all the meticulous planning phases and intelligence gathering phases, they had called it Operation Seeds of Summer. But Arnon Zamora risked his life to stand uncompromisingly against evil and to free these four people. And he lost his life in that noble stand, so it was officially renamed Operation Arnon. But the four hostages are free. And when you consider everything else that could have gone wrong in this operation, and all the obstacles that had to be surmounted, you see that that is truly extraordinary.
The IDF, with pretty much every Special Forces unit, and the Air Force, and tanks, pulled out hostages from the heart of Gaza, where the terrorists were waiting for them, in broad daylight, pulled them out alive against all the odds. It is an incredible, incredible, incredible operation.
That's Mati Shoshana there, who I mentioned earlier with the TBN Israel channel. And then his colleague, Yael Pinto, adds this observation.
I don't think Israel did this since the Entebbe operation.
TBN Israel is not the only outlet that is comparing Operation Arnon to the Entebbe operation. Several commentators have compared it to that famous Entebbe rescue that happened back in 1976. After terrorists had hijacked a plane filled with mostly Israelis and had held them hostage in Entebbe, Uganda. And the Israelis at that time conducted a now historic rescue mission to free the hostages. At that time, in 1976, world-famous educator Herbert W. Armstrong said that in the Entebbe rescue, the Israelis had, quote, showed the rest of the world an example of how to deal with this international menace of terrorism. Mr. Armstrong also said the rescuers had given the world, quote, an example of daring, courage, and efficient execution in a lightning military operation. Mr. Armstrong's statements about it were published in the Plain Truth magazine of September 1976, and I think that it is entirely valid to compare last month's Operation Arnon to the Entebbe operation. Both of these show us an example of daring courage and efficient execution, as Mr. Armstrong said. Seeing the courage and resolve and heroism and sacrifice that freed these four hostages last month from wicked terrorists, it is very inspiring. But at the same time, these four people, after 8 months of very bleak captivity, need a lot of healing. And there are still around 80 other hostages believed to still be alive and still captive at various locations inside the Gaza Strip. In tunnels, in compounds and civilian houses, these people all need to be freed from the terrorists. And maybe the success of Operation Arnon will inspire more hope and more rescue operations. And maybe it'll get more of these diamonds into the hands of the heroic rescuers so that they can be returned to safety. It gives us a lot to think and pray about. While we are coming to the end of this episode of The Sun Also Rises, we will leave a link in the show notes to Mr. Stephen Fleury's Trumpet Daily episode, in which he goes through what Mr. Armstrong wrote about the Entebbe rescue and the lesson from that that we can apply in our lives. That all takes on fresh relevance, I think, in light of last month's Operation Arnon. Well, we really appreciate you tuning in today, and we'll leave you with one last quote from Yael Pinto about Operation Arnon. He said, "I think that God gave us this win and this opportunity to save these hostages and bring them home alive in order to give us hope, because the country really needed that, and it really encourages us to know that there is hope."